Welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast, the podcast for cinephiles who don't really want to know that much about the movie that they're talking about. All they want to hear are bits. They just want to hear bits. I'm Daniel Barnes, quasi pseudo professional film critic, master of bits. And with me, as always, the kibbles to my bits. Of course, you know who it is. It's Corky McDonald.
Well, Dan, hello, everybody. And I would like to say that I was chomping at the bit
sir,
to concur.
Humans,
you are a master
horses
bitter.
Champ, sir. Humans chomp, horses champ.
Yes.
How dare you, sir? That is, I am offended.
But you are a master bidder.
Of all things equine.
You're always master bidding.
And equus.
You master bid all over the place.
Oh, yeah. The master, I'm embarrassed.
Too much, actually.
Yes. No, actually, getting caught on Zoom, that Jeffrey tubing it, just free tubing it. I don't know how that happened. But
the bits.
The point is the bits. The bits.
They don't stop.
That's what the ladies are.
They call you Drill Bit Taylor.
They call me Drill Bit Taylor.
Yes. Because you just hammer these bits, and few people know you were a semi-quasi-professional tailor at one time.
Oh, that's so true. Speaking of hammering bits, Quirky, this bit's pretty hammered, I think.
Yeah, I think
we stripped the nail on this one. Like, that's never coming out. But also, I want to continue a bit that we've been doing this year, where we've been talking about some of the big film festivals of the year. We talked in previous episodes about Sundance Film Festival. We talked about the Cannes Film Festival. And just about a week ago as we're recording this, although like a month and a half as this will actually come out, the Toronto International Film Festival, TIFF, as I like to call it. I get into a big TIFF when I talk about TIFF. Oh, that just finished up on September 14. And if you go back to those episodes, during the Sundance episode, we talked about the Grand Jury Prize. That's their top prize. How that's not necessarily a strong indicator of Oscar and award season performance. Palme d'Or, the big Cannes prize, that's a little stronger of an indicator. They do okay, right? Like Anora last year took the Palme d'Or, ended up winning Best Picture. But there is no better bellwether this early in the season, in September, you know, again, the Oscars aren't for another 6 months or so, than the TIFF People's Choice Award. Quirky, if you get that TIFF Audience Award, you can just bank on a Best Picture nomination. Rack it up, write it down, Larry Bird putting up the finger before the three-pointer even goes in. Like, just
you can take out your Oscar loan just with that.
Start do high stepping into the end zone.
On that one.
Abso-freaking-lutely. From 2008 to 2023, 15 of the 16 People's Choice Award winners received a Best Picture nomination. Five went on to win Best Picture. Last year's winner, The Life of Chuck, was actually released to theaters this year, earlier this year. So it's still eligible. So we'll see what happens there. But they do give a top three, and the other two from last year were Emilia Perez and, again, eventual Best Picture winner, Anora. So, 2025, TIFF, who's in the catbird seat? Corky, it's Hamnet. It's Hamnet. It's awkward to say, but it is Hamnet. This is the latest film from Chloe Zhao. She won Best Director and Best Picture for Nomadland, which was also the 2020 TIFF People's Choice Award winner. Aha. It stars Paul Mescal, Jess Buckley. It's based on the novel by Maggie O'Farrell about Shakespeare and the tragic story behind the creation of Hamlet. Corky, you've heard of Shakespeare in Love. Here you are, Shakespeare in Death. You got love, you got death. It'll work either
okay.
way.
Shakespeare in Le Petit Mort.
I'm fascinated that Hamlet is just, can't stop. I don't know, have you heard of this movie, Grand Theft Hamlet?
No.
This is a movie that came out, I guess was released to theaters earlier this year, but was started creating during the pandemic, which was a bunch of people who got together on the sort of shared universe of Grand Theft Auto, you know, where you get in like the multiplayer universe, and recreated Hamlet in the universe.
Holy shit.
I haven't seen the film, but I mean, again, Hamlet, Hamnet, Grand Theft? I don't know. We got a new Grand Theft Auto coming out next year too. I mean, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, don't count on that.
Also looking good. Second and third place winners at TIFF, for the audience award, it was Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein with Oscar Isaac as the Doctor and Rian Johnson's Wake Up Dead Man, which is the latest Knives Out film, starring Daniel Craig. Corky, of all those that I mentioned, are there any that stick out to you as like, oh shit, I can't wait to see this?
Don't hate me too much, but the Grand Theft Hamlet sounds
Grand Theft the Hamlet, absolutely. If we could only do Grand Theft Hamnet. You know, yeah. Like really best of or worst of both worlds. You know, Oscars, award season still to come. We'll have more on that. Of course, I'll be voting in the San Francisco Bay Area Film Critics Circle Awards in December. And we'll talk about it all at the end of the year, but just trying to get you psyched up for... This is the season of quality, ostensibly.
Sure.
At least. Most of the great movies will come out this year. A lot of unmemorable stuff, a lot of stuff that'll get hyped and forgotten, but also a lot of really exciting stuff. So, anyway, that's where we're at.
And since you mentioned Sundance, I'd like to take a moment just say RIP Robert Redford, one of the best to ever do it. The Sundance kid passed recently. And hey, while we're at it, RIP Claudia Cardinale, she passed today.
Wow.
So, yeah. No, just hitting some of the all-timers.
True all-timers. Yeah, long-timers. I did actually just a few weeks ago, actually, for the very first time, watch Jeremiah Johnson, which I think you talked about as a movie you've seen a bunch of times, right?
Are you fucking... That was your first time?
No, I've never... I don't know. Like, that's one of those weird things of like, how did this slip through the cracks? But yeah, I mean, it was awesome, too. It was a really
good movie. Absolutely gorgeous movie.
Fantastic, yeah, and Redford's amazing. Redford's amazing. Of course, that's the source of the meme, the famous meme of
the
mountain man turning and smiling and nodding. Yeah,
yeah.
So anyway, yeah. R.I.P. to Redford and to Claudia.
And as we discuss season of quality, we'll move into the season of disquality, where it's just me and Daniel talking for the next rest of the episode.
Yeah, then it gets brutal.
The little bridge between those two, where it's still quality, is this moment where we take a moment to thank our PayPal donors. Today, I'd like to call them our Paythar Pen Pally donors. That's actually, I'll never call you that again. You are our PayPal supporters, the lifeblood of this show, with the heroes. Without you, we could not do the show, and we thank you and love you so much. And really, your continued support keeps us going.
Yeah, I agree. Well, like Paythar, but we find out it's the song of the long road, I think is how that's... pronounced. So you think
Little Road,
the song of the Little Road. Yeah, so you think our donors are songs of the Little Road. I don't know. Yeah, anyway,
yeah, they're little roadies.
Oh they are little. That's why they're constantly grabbing my guitar gear. Oh,
exactly.
I'm like, what, why are you here? And then it's off they scurry. There they go, just little roadies. If you would like to become one of the little roadies, one of our little roadies, or if you just want to, you know, give us some cash, head over to daredaniel.com, find the menu at the top of the page, click support the show, or find that donate button on the homepage. You can make a one-time donation, a monthly donation, a yearly donation. I don't think you can go farther than yearly. I think it's going to have to stop it. You can't go like every decade.
Okay.
Like every 25 years, check in and be like, eh.
And I'd worry about you, honestly. It's got to be
yearly or less. Yeah, like, I've heard of a five-year plan, but wow.
Yeah.
You've planned it out even as
the You have the bigger things donation? To focus on for 25 years down the road.
Seriously. Seriously. I mean, I don't even want to talk about it. I mean, Paythar Panchali, I think, is probably going to give us as strong of a preview of it as anything. That's probably a good segue. Anyway, any contribution helps keep this show going. Thank you so much to our donors and future donors. I thank you in the future. Time travel being possible in the future.
Today's episode, we'll be discussing Satyajit Ray's 1955 debut film, Paythar Panchali. The synopsis of Paythar Panchali via IMDb, and as we all know, IMDb stands for I'm Doing Bits. Impoverished priest Harahar Ray, dreaming of a better life for himself and his family, leaves his rural Bengal village in search of work.
Yes, this week's film, it's Paythar Panchali. And boy, how insufficient is that IMDb synopsis? I mean, we've seen some bad ones. That doesn't cover it at all. Impoverished priest Harahar Ray, not the main character of this movie by a fucking long shot. Not even top three. Good job, IMDb. All right. Petha Panchali, written and directed by Satyajit Ray. You might remember him from Charulata, baby.
Bang, bang.
It's in our canon. We liked it. The Lonely Wife. She's lonely no more. She's got a lot of company in that canon. You know what I mean? Where am I at here? Satyajit Ray, the most respected and influential Indian filmmaker of all time. That's it. That's the highlight, right? This was his debut film. It's based on the 1929 book of the same name by, and I apologize for this, Bibhuti Bhushan Bandiyopadhyay. Pretty good, right? Interesting, as a young graphic designer, that's where Satyajit got his start. He created illustrations for an abridged version of this book, but he read the unabridged version and thought, hey, this might be a good movie. This film was shot on location with the very inexperienced crew. You had a few veterans there from Jean Renoir's The River. Renoir in the early 50s went to India and shot a film called The River. Great film. And mostly amateur actors. And Quirky, I think we're from that video store generation, so I think a lot of people from that generation have had that dream of getting all your friends together, just getting whatever cash and credit cards you can, making your little movie on the weekends, you know, right, whenever you can, in fits and starts, whenever anyone has time, trying to make that film. Yeah. This is going to look so much better than any of our movies would have ever looked. How does this look so fucking beautiful? How is this so amazing? How is he so good at filmmaking? In his first go. That is
out the gate.
Absolutely unbelievable. This is not Orson Welles, veteran of stage, veteran of radio, a practiced entertainer, doing this on his first try. That's amazing. Don't get me wrong. Not discounting it. This is somebody who is basically self-taught. Somebody who has never been in the entertainment industry on any level. And he's doing this on his first time. It's absolutely unbelievable. We talked in our Charlie Ulacha review about Ray, his background. I won't rehash it all. But remember, it was a screening of The Bicycle Thief, that's episode 3, that really inspired Ray to become a filmmaker. And this is a film that has a lot of those neorealist qualities, more than Charulata, I think, while having its own cultural flavor and its own stylistic flavor. I'm thinking mainly about that lyrical, dreamlike quality that we saw in Charulata. That, I think, differentiates him from, the Italian neorealist of De Sica, who brings a comedic element, or Rossellini, who brings this more socialist kind of element to it. Took nearly 3 years to shoot the film. No script, just storyboards and notes.
Damn.
Ravi Shankar, holy crap, this movie takes it to that next level, that Raga score by Ravi Shankar. West Bengal government saved this production. The movie actually, the first credit is presented by the government of West Bengal. They purchased the movie for $60,000. John Huston also played a big role. He was in India in the mid-1950s scouting for The Man Who Would Be King, his first attempt to make that film. He eventually made it in the 70s. The head of MoMA had Huston look in on Ray, and Huston said the footage was, quote, the work of a great filmmaker. So it actually premiered at the New York Museum of Modern Art May 3rd, 1955. Part of the Textiles and Ornamental Arts of India exhibition. That's your birthday. Yeah.
My negative 21st birthday.
Predates you, right? You were negative on the able to drink legally, finally. That's great. Although I'm sure you already had a fake negative ID.
Buddy.
Sure.
Yeah. It's so easy to get it where I grew up.
In before the negative I grew world? Up. Yes. Released in Calcutta on August 26, 1955. The premiere was attended by the Chief Minister of West Bengal and the Prime Minister of India. I mean, this was a big deal. And I think for a lot of people in India, you know, they were kind of seeing themselves on screen for the first time. You know, there was Indian films made, but genre films, musicals, comedies, action films, not stories of poverty, stories of, you know, the people living hand to mouth. And there were detractors. There absolutely were detractors, but it was enthusiastically received at home and abroad for the most part. Ran for 8 months in New York and inspired two sequels, Aparajito in 1956 and The World of Apu in 1959, collectively known as the Apu trilogy. It's one of two Satyajit Rays on the Titan Sound Top 250. We already reviewed and canonized Charu Lata, which is tied at number 169. Paither Panchali, it sits much higher at number 35. Quirky, does it deserve such a lofty ranking?
Flat out, yes.
Hey.
This is, yeah, it's a fantastic, beautiful movie. I don't get how someone can never be a filmmaker before, and yet there's not a bad shot in this. And not just not a bad shot, there are stunning shots and choices. The depth of field employed is like you're gifted with an eye to be able to do that. There's a shot of kids running to a field, and it's like, I'm sure there's literally thousands of fields he could have chose to have kids run into, but this one just zigzags at this perfect little moment, and the camera does this lift from watching the kids run from down, you know, it's a up high shot and then lifts up and kind of wide zoom shot the whole scenery and breadth of this countryside. It's just, that's just like one little element while Ravi Shankar music is playing. And if the camera's placed on the ground, if the camera's placed mid shot, if the camera's up close talk, watching two people while some action happens behind, there's not a bad shot, and it's shooting on location around destitute poverty and conditions that like almost were Aguirre-like, you know, like very, very, I'm sure there were mudslides. I'm sure there was like no roof in some days. So anyway, yes, it belongs on here. Fantastic masterpiece film.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Absolutely. I mean, it's just unbelievable that you do this on your first time out. And it's a beautiful film. Even if this was his 30th film, it would be an absolutely remarkable film. And although I don't think he ever intended to actually make sequels, he did make two more films. And they're both really good. But like, and you could even say, I think that the third one is like Charu Lata. It's maybe more like accomplished in a way. It's more kind of like it's more the work of a professional filmmaker, I think. But at the same time, I also think of it as like, you know, some of those Wu-Tang Clan albums are
yeah,
like so many great songs, and you could maybe make a case that they're better than the, you know, the actual, like the first Enter the 36 Chambers, right? But like, it, that first Wu-Tang Clan album is always going to be the best. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just can never not be the best because it is the best, right? It's the origin story. And so this is always going to be the best. Even if maybe other films surpassed it, this is still always just the best. And I wrote a review of this, and I'll post it on the post for this show. I'll link it on the post for this show. I wrote the review for this for Dare Daniel about 10 years ago for daredaniel.com, which was then eStreetFilmSociety.com. And I said about, at that time, it had been 10 years since I'd seen it. It's been another 10 years since I've wrote that review. And I wrote that I hadn't seen the film in about a decade, and revisiting it felt like making a pilgrimage to a sacred temple, nourishing and rejuvenating. And I think this is one of those movies that you should, if you really love it, you'll want to return to it, even though it's a really tragic story. I mean, it's
yeah,
a bummer. You know, it's not going to be one of those every Christmas kind of watches, you know what I mean? But it's got like one every 10 years or so, I think it's good to go back to it. Towards the end of the film, there's a scene where like this woman who has been the most terrible person in the entire movie, this absolutely horrible, greedy woman who calls the heroes of our film greedy, and she's just an absolutely terrible person. But at the end, she says, like, they're leaving this place, and she says, like, good, like, you shouldn't stay in one place too long. It makes you, like, it makes you mean, it makes you angry, and makes you, like, small. And that's what's happened to me. I need to go on a pilgrimage. I need to go out and like get out of myself and go on a pilgrimage and like get better. And it's like kind of like, wow, that's like kind of awesome to see someone who's been so horrible actually kind of acknowledge their horribleness. But yeah. Also, I think it talks about like, you know, the I don't know, the rejuvenating possibility of film and cinema and making you kind of feel like, you know what, if you're feeling a little raw and you're feeling a little like low on your empathy meter, I don't know. Maybe it's a good time to revisit the Renoirs and the Satyajit Rays of the world.
I was struck by the way time passed in this movie because there's several different methods employed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know exactly how much time passes, but you can tell it's a significant amount of time. And some is just the growth of the children.
Mm-hmm.
A baby and a young girl, and then it's a preteen girl and her 67-year-old brother running around. Kittens become cats.
Mm-hmm.
A little tiny tree we see watered with care mm-hmm. is now 2 feet tall, but still a spindly little tree that gets watered with care. The fields they run in, one day they encounter power lines with no cognizant understanding yes. of what these are. But that wasn't there before. And what is that? That's heralding something very distant and futuristic. So much so that they hug the power lines just to feel the vibration and sound mm-hmm. coming from them.
Yeah, it's making a sound that is, it's alien. Like you think of like,
yeah.
They're so far from having electricity. They don't really have like a window. You know what I mean? They don't have
a sink. Hole.
They don't have running water. They don't have anything, right? So to suddenly encounter power lines that are making this otherworldly hum. It's so alien to them. But what is so marvelous about Ray is that like there's no need to like overemphasize that or explain it. They don't talk to each other. They're like, what is this? I don't get it. Blah, blah, you know what I mean? Like it's just the poetry of it is just allowing it to happen and just framing it in such a beautiful way. Yeah.
It also comes from a moment when they're fighting. She's very mad at him and he's just kind of following her. She won't talk to him. These are the brother and sister, the young ones. And he's following her like, you know, little brothers do, and she won't talk to him. But then they encounter something that's so big and foreign to them. Mm. It's like, okay, it just instantly resolves that.
And it's awe-inspiring. And they've never seen a train. This is like the train scene, mm-hmm. too, which is one of the most famous scenes in the film. Like the kid talks about like they can hear a train because trains are pretty loud. But have you ever actually seen a train? I mean, this is how removed from the kind of technological modern world that they are.
The other thing that heralded the passing of time and was probably my favorite way of doing it is the festivals. Mm-hmm. You just see getting ready for festivals or discussing people coming to town. That's a rare occurrence, but it's telling you like these are once a year. These are the things in this daily humdrum, poverty-stricken rural Indian life. That's what they look forward to, and that's how they mark the time. And that's how we mark the time in the movie.
Yeah, it's so true. And it's just great because this is like a staple of like movies about small town life. Recently, me and the wife, we watched, I think a couple of years ago we watched the 1930s version of State Fair. And then just a couple of weeks ago, we watched the 1950s State Fair, which is a musical. And those movies are both built around this idea of like, you're in a country, you live in the middle of nowhere. Nothing happens all year long except for the state fair. And that's your one chance to sign. And it's your chance to sign because for these people, it's about entering contests and winning blue ribbons and things like that. And it's something to prove that like you actually matter, you know, and your lives are interesting, you know, or it's like the circus coming to town, you know, in any of these kind of films. So, but it does it in this way that is just so uniquely West Bengali, is so well identified with this culture. It's really awesome. So let's talk about the family a little bit. So you've got Dad Harihar.
Yeah.
Dad, this is why it was ridiculous that they talk about this as being IMDb synopsis, acts like he's sort of the star of the film. He's absent for so much of this film. And when he's there, he's a very benign sort of presence. You know, he's the dad who likes to be pleasant. You know, he likes to make the kids happy and things like that. The mom is Sarbhaya. Mom runs the damn household. Mom does everything.
Yeah.
And once again, this, I think, is sort of a feminist before feminism kind of thing for Satyajit Ray, much like Charulata, the lonely wife. I mean, we have so much empathy for Sarbbhaya by the time this movie's over. At first, it's just like she's just hectoring. But at the same time, it's like you feel so much for her. You know, this early scene of the daughter is Durga, okay? She steals fruit from the orchard, you know, even though they feel somewhat entitled to it because they feel they were this was their orchard and they were cheated at it. She steals fruit. This woman, this is the horrible woman I was talking about earlier, she's talking about this girl and about her mother and all these things, and Satyajit Ray cuts to this woman. We have not met her yet. This is Sarbbhaya. We know instantly this is who is being talked about. We know within 1 second of the look on her face, how he lingers on her, this is the woman being talked about, and she's absolutely devastated. Devastated. I mean, she's embarrassed and feels shame for her poverty for no real reason. Dad Harahar, he's gone because he's a poet. He's a writer. He's not anything that anyone in this little village needs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's trying to go out to, you know, cities on the road and sell his stuff on the road. But it's not really working. So Sarbbhaya is forced to just endure this poverty, this house, their ancestral home that's falling apart. And Auntie Indir, which is a very old woman who is kind of mooching off of them and is often kind of the focus of the ire of Sarbbhaya. The daughter, again, is Durga, who just longs for the things that, you know, little girls long for, right? Which is just something that's hers. And then the youngest boy, who is born in this kind of first little sequence here, is Apu, and this is who will follow through the rest of the trilogy and is the main character in the second and third films.
Yeah, that IMDb synopsis really whitewashes the father, because it says impoverished priest Harahar dreaming of a better life for himself and his family. No, he has to go. He's not dreaming of it. He wouldn't do it if he didn't have to.
No, and exactly. And it's like there's things that are broken around the house and he's not fixing them, right?
Nope.
He's out on the road trying to sell his poetry, and when he's at home he's smoking his hookah and is pleasant and is always talking of a positive future and is talking about how this is God's will and all that kind of stuff. But eventually this comes, I don't want to skip ahead too far, but I mean it comes to such a tragic end of just horrible timing and things, and it's all really caused by the fact that like their poverty is just a bottomless pit. Like they just cannot get out. When we start, they're in debt, deeply in debt, in a house that is completely falling apart, no real resources or anything. And it kind of, the birth of Apu is supposed to be this kind of hopeful moment of like, this is where it all kind of changes. You know, we're talking about a better future, but we cut ahead to Apu as a little kid. Nothing's really changed, you know?
No.
Nothing's changed. It's really gotten a little bit worse, probably.
Yeah. Another time marker in this is you see the mother, she's doesn't want to beg, doesn't want her daughter stealing anymore.
Yeah.
So she is fighting with the auntie who stays there, who does, mm-hmm. you know, pinch their stuff. And she's walking with a suitcase and drops the suitcase. Now, I didn't pick up what was happening. She drops the suitcase and out spills like cups and shit. I didn't mm-hmm. get that she's selling that stuff, mm-hmm. but she's so embarrassed. She's carrying it to hide because she doesn't want her neighbors knowing what she's doing. By the end of the film, or you know, near the end of the film, she's openly walking her fucking bridal gifts, her best, most cherished plates and stuff to sell because they have nothing.
They just have nothing. And
less than
again,
nothing.
Remember, this is like the 20s or so, and they have no electricity, there's no phones, there's no anything. So the dad's out on the road, and there's no way to get any word home. There's no way to say, like, okay, well, except for the mail, and if he's not writing, then there's nothing, right? And he's not writing. Yeah, I mean, she's giving away the things that, like, you don't ever take out. You're giving the things that are in the drawer that you never, ever take out. Those are your prized possessions. Those are the things that you never, ever, ever would sell. And she's selling them for rice.
Yeah.
Just for rice.
For a handful of rice.
And it doesn't last. It doesn't last. That's it. Yeah, it's brutal, but also a lot of this movie, I think, like, you know, so many similarities, I think, to Yi Yi, the movie we reviewed on our last episode, in like this multi-generational story and just all of these kind of like kind of ties kind of going back and forth between each other. I think like the children, the special relationship the children have with the grandparents, and this sort of like secrets and shame that the adults are feeling about like the way that they're living.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it's again, like that movie had such a uniquely Taiwanese flavor to it. This has such a uniquely Bengali flavor to it. So I think it's just different ways of kind of looking at the same sort of thing. I will tell you, Durga got to me. Durga, you know.
Yeah. Whatever.
I'm a paternal man. You know what I mean? Like, but man, Durga is like, and this is, again, this is what I love about Ray, is that like he doesn't let her off the hook necessarily, but at the same time, like, God, you feel for her so much. You really do. I mean, you feel for everyone. This is the Renoirian element of this movie, is the kind of like, you feel for everyone here.
Yeah.
It's not like Harahar is some asshole. Like, what, it's awesome to be out like wandering for like months at a time while your family's dying or something like that. Sarbahaya and all of her hectoring. I mean, yeah, you feel for her. You feel for Auntie Indir, even as she's pinching chilies and stealing guava and things like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I felt as the most, I think, for Durga and just her simple longing. Her simple longing for like things that every child should have, like,
yes,
you know, a little candy if they're good, right? Or like a toy, a special toy, a special present, something just for you, something just for you. And she doesn't have it. And so it starts as like the candy, the sweets seller, right? The sweet seller scene is fabulous, right? The music is fabulous. The framing, the shots, the editing, everything is fabulous. They're following this the sweet seller. He's just this big burly man carrying these, you know, big baskets on the two ends of a stick. Nothing for this house. He's going to move on, but they know that at the next house, someone's getting some candy. The candy will be flowing. And I mean, this isn't even like candy like we know it. It's not like Skittles and Starburst and shit like that. It's lentil cakes. You know what I mean? that's what we're talking about here. Lentil cakes. But there's just that scene of like she's hanging around hoping she'll get a cake, hoping she'll get to play with this beaded necklace, hoping, you know, this or that. And she, it's just not happening. And I think like for me, the scene of the film, quietly the scene of the film for me, is this scene where Durga is watching her friend get married. Durga's like, what, 12, 13 years old?
Yeah.
Something like that.
12, 13.
You're better. That's what we've established. I don't know what age anyone under 30 is. I couldn't tell you. I have no fucking clue. But yeah, so she's a kid, right? But she's watching her friend getting married, which as Westerners, on the one hand, this is horrifying, right? This is like a child. I don't think we ever see who she's getting married to, but this is a horrible thing. But at the same time, the look on Durga's face and the way, once again, that Ray lingers on it, the way he just sticks on it, doesn't cut away. And as you see her look, it tells us everything. And what it says is that she gets that this is just one more thing that is not for her. It's for her friends, and it's not for her. And you know what? You can't give a bite of your marriage to someone, to your friend. You know what I mean? This is not for her. It's never for her because her family's too poor. This is the lentil cakes and the beaded necklaces of her impending adulthood. And adulthood hits fucking fast. If you're a 12-year-old, you're smashing right into that wall like a crash test dummy, okay? And that, I think, is like this remarkable, again, somewhat nourishing empathy of Ray, which is this thing where we can see something that seems very wrong to us, and yet at the same time, we can empathize for like why somebody would want that and why they feel terrible for not having it. So I think, again, just a remarkable fucking movie.
And yeah, my favorite parts were definitely the interplay with Durga and Apu, having an older sister where it's just me and her. I kind of got that relationship really of the sister. Well, like,
sister anytime knows all the angles, right?
Like, sister wants something, she tells her little brother to ask the baby. For the money.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
It's I'm not going to get in trouble if it doesn't go the right way, but also you're cuter, you're sweeter, you're younger.
She's got it all figured out.
So I love the part where, so we've seen this as their pattern, and he's, even Apu is hip to it, is like, he's not going to say yes, he's just going to get mad, you know? But like when the dad's leaving, he feels a little guilty, you know what's going to happen, or you don't know what's going to happen. You see Apu from a distance run up to the dad, and we don't get the shot of the dad agreeing or pulling out money. We get the reaction shot of Durga watching from afar, from behind, and see her excitedly smile and run towards. So it's like, boom, it worked. You know, that's such a simple, brilliant way to tell that, because that's who's the happiest, you know? And we're kind of like happy for her that she gets this thing finally.
Yeah.
And then the other moment I really loved, and probably one of my favorite parts of the movie, is when she discovers that Apu has been through her stuff and he's taken her aluminum foil. Like, first she's like, oh, okay, she's the stuff that's he's awesome. Got. And then cool it clicks. Yeah. She's like, where'd you get the foil? You know, and then she goes and looks at her stuff. It's all been rummaged. And then for the next, I don't know, minute, she chases them around their decrepit house through these two windows at this corner. And while she's chasing them through, they're doing the old, like, they can't see if they're over there or not. Yeah. So they double back. And that would have been a whole movie, like in 1910, like just that, some just French aristocrat would have filmed that in his garden. And Satyajit Ray just captures it so beautifully in the Ravi Shankar music behind it. They're half mad, half just kids having fun.
Yeah.
Playing chase, you know? And I love that. I love the interplay with the two.
Yeah. With no real kind of like awareness of like, I don't know, that how much of a shambles their house is in. It's just like, this is just the giant human-sized hole in our wall. You know,
yeah,
and that's actually that is first, like, we first see that in a scene again with Durga. So there's this whole thing with the necklace, right? As they follow the sweet seller, she gets a bite of the lentil cake or whatever, but also she sees another friend who is this beaded necklace, and she's beating it, and she says, you know, let me try, and the friend says, no, you're not gonna try. And this is just a simple thing. It's just beads on a string. This is all she's doing here. It's not some kind of, it's not a Game Boy, for fuck's sake. It's just a beads and a necklace, right? Beads and a string. Later she's accused of stealing that necklace, right? And denies it. That's not really proven, but it also like kind of starts this whole thing with her mom where she doesn't really trust her. She kind of drags her out of the house and essentially kicks her out of the house. But as we see it, it's a scene where she throws her out through the door, slams the door, but we can see the mom kind of like breaking down inside because there's a huge hole in the wall that any human, any 500 pound or less human could walk through without even touching the sides, right? Like, it is a giant hole, and it's like, it's such a symbolic thing to be like, slam the door on your daughter. You can just walk in the house, like, right away. Also, you don't have a window, so you can just walk in there anytime. So, but yeah, it's just this thing of like, it's like we feel it because it's like a classic, like, mom and her rebellious daughter kind of moment of like, you crossed that Rubicon, you went too far, you've shamed me as a mother, get out. But also, you can just walk right in, right? Like, this means nothing, right? As far as like a realistic way of keeping you out of the house. But yeah, that's so good. And then and I would say, like, if you have never seen this film and you don't want any spoilers, shut off for the first few minutes, for the next few minutes. Last chance. There you go. But this all kind of comes to a head. Everything we've been talking about comes to a head, right? This whole marriage thing. When she sees it, she decides she's going to like kind of cast a spell or something like that, like pray to this goddess about like this thing. And this is why she's out dancing in the rain, right? And she gets caught out in this rainstorm, eventually catches a fever. And we've learned from the very beginning, you know, it's like the Chekhov's virus.
She's kind of sickly.
It's like, that she's already like kind of prone to fevers. And so, again, the storm comes in and the wind blows, the window is just a rag over a bare hole, and the door breaks open because it's very creaky and poorly made. The entire house falls apart, and yes, eventually she does die of her fever, and it's really sad. But then Apu, the little brother, finds the necklace as they're leaving. He finds the necklace. He's like, it's hidden away so well over a doorway. He finds it, and one of my favorite moments, he throws it in the lake.
Yeah.
He's never going to give anyone the satisfaction.
Nope. Fuck
never,
them.
Never, never will give them the satisfaction. Never will give, never will let mom think that her daughter would do that. We'll let mom go to her grave thinking, you know, that her daughter is not a thief, you know? So, yeah. But at the same time, it's not like, oh, wow, we really hate Durga now.
No.
We were all fine with her stealing the necklace in the first place. Like, my God, yeah. Like, she has nothing. Nothing. And they get shit on so much.
Even the mom basically kills the grandma.
Yeah.
But you get it because the mom's like, I can't. You're
like, what?
You can't
what
die else? Here.
She's also not is she the grandma? They call her auntie, but I don't know if that's
auntie.
Like
she's like everybody's. She's an elder. She's everybody's. But it's like, auntie. You're just my problem now.
Exactly.
If you stay here, I can't do that. I have a dying child. We're all going to die if
no
I don't
money.
Get food.
Yeah.
So I got it, even though she does it in a very horrible way, but that's what that woman's counting mm-hmm. on.
Exactly.
And the dad basically kills Durga because he won't fix a fucking thing around the house.
Absolutely. And comes home too late. Comes home a day too late, you know, which is insane. And, you know, we talked about, like, the score by Ravi Shankar, but also I think, like, the use of music as, like, almost a sound effect at mm-hmm. times. I think that scene where Sarvajaya is pulling Durga by her hair and throws her out, and the music kind of comes up in this sort of screaming, sort of discordant sort of way. And then here with the dad, when he realizes, comes home and realizes, like, oh my God, like it comes out as sort of a scream.
Like it's the sound of the dialogue cuts out and it's an empty wail, but the music replaces it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, that's another thing is like the images are great, but also like to have that like multidimensional understanding of cinema to like that great use of off-screen sound.
Yeah.
Great use of like music and editing and sound and understanding how all of those things work together. It's this is just such a great film. So Corky, before we wrap it up, was there a scene or any sequence or shot or anything else you wanted to call out?
Yeah, two more things I want to say. It's a film in black and white, but the film and the look of it is so rich. I joke about the cliche, like the setting is a character, but the use of the natural jungle overgrowth in that area is so good. It's creeping into every aspect. In fact, taking over some aspects of their life while they have nothing, stuff abounds around them.
Good point.
And it's a kind of also has trapped them in this place. And then one scene that really stuck me was when they go to the festival where the band is playing. Mm. There's this marching band with all these instruments. And it's obvious the children, all boys, have gathered around this all-male marching band. And they just have never seen this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like sousaphones, trombones, trumpets. And the looks on their face is like they can't figure out. It's not, yay, it's not dancing. It's just like staring. It's so good.
Slightly confused, yeah.
Because Satyajit Ray is just dipping into his bag here with all the different shots up close to the band, up close to the kids, far away, shot, reverse shot, that kind of stuff, following the instruments as they sway and rock, and panning from one old man talking to another one. It's just so good. And it's no dialogue. But you get what's going on.
It's really good, yeah. And how nothing you're getting from any of the band players. And we should really add also that this is high school band, like, level.
Yeah.
This is not, like, they're bragging about how good their bands are, but it's, like, No, this, like, if this was a high school band, you would be like, that was okay.
Yeah. This is like when Andre 3000,
I've heard better.
Andre 3000 would dress as a band leader. You're like, you know, you're not playing anything.
All right. Well, let's remind everybody about our rating system here on the Cannon Fodder podcast. If we both, that's both of us, think it was a sound selection, kaboom, the cannons roar into the Cannon Fodder cannon. It goes, if one or both of us think it was a little slight, no cannon for you, but we'll select a slighted movie, not in the Sight and Sound Top 250, to put in its place. Corky.
Yeah.
Beta Panchali. Slight or sound?
Sound, baby, sound. Really
sound
was
trombones.
A film that...
Yes. Sound a sousaphone.
It gave me a feeling of Bicycle Thieves because of the realism aspect. Los Olvidados, because of the portrayal of poverty and that you actually feel something for people who just have to survive in this kind of thing. And also, it just fucking tears you apart like Bicycle Thieves did too. But also, I don't want to... You're very happy for people in this movie as well. You're very, you enjoy the beauty of it and the beauty of their childhood. God damn, what a debut.
Yeah, heck of a movie. 400 Blows maybe also with.
I was going to say 400 Blows. Sorry,
how accomplished of a debut this is, and how much it understands children, and how universal it is. With children, you know, we talked about 400 Blows, and like, if you've ever been a young boy in school, you fucking get this movie. I mean, if you've ever been a young girl who like looks and says, wow, I want that, you know, or any child who's kind of looks at something and says like, I don't get that, but
yeah,
I've seen somebody else get that and I want it. That's universal. You know what I mean? It doesn't need to be happening in a jungle necessarily, but this movie is just such a amazing film, and it's that Renoir level of empathy. I don't think we've done a Renoir movie yet, have we? I don't know if there's another one besides Rules of the Game, which is in our canon. We talked about it in our year end last year for
yeah.
a few minutes, but we haven't actually done a full Renoir review. I'll have to look and see if he's got anything else.
Wait, Rules of the Game isn't an episode? We just discussed it?
No, we just discussed it. That was like a year-end episode. We discussed that. We discussed The Wrong Man. We discussed a couple other things on that one.
Okay.
As a whole. But yeah, it is in the can. It is in our canon, though. It's officially,
gotcha.
Officially canonized. And you know what else is? Kaboom, Pather fucking Panchali. Oh.
Fuck yeah. So that's what we felt about Pather Panchali. But what did you feel about Pather Panchali? Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? What films did it remind you of? We'd love to hear your take. Contact us on Facebook and Instagram at daredanielpod and tell us your thoughts.
But now, Corky, it is time to pick the film that we will review in 2 weeks on our next episode. And to do that, we need to summon our good friends, the gods of the random number generator. I will say the incantation. It's inaudible to human ears. And here they come. Boop, still scrolling, boop, beep, still scrolling, it's at the bottom, boop.
This is people's Corky. Favorite part of this.
why don't people love this? Corky, the film we will be... oh my God, Corky. Try it again. Corky, the film we will be reviewing in 2 weeks, as determined by the random number generator gods. Remember, don't blame me. It is Sans Tuite Ni Trois, otherwise known as Vagabond. I will read the IMDb synopsis. A young woman's body is found frozen in a ditch. Through flashbacks and interviews, we see the events that led to her inevitable death. Corky, have you seen Vagabond? Are you familiar with Agnes Varda? How excited are you?
I have not seen Vagabond. I know Varda from Gleaners and I.
Yep.
And
that which is also on this list, the Sight and Sound list, but we're doing Vagabond. We're getting to Vagabond first. I've never seen this movie. I've seen some of Agnes Varda's later works, but I am woefully uninformed on Ms. Varda and her earlier works, so I am very excited to see this film. It's only 105 minutes. It is available on
Holy Criterion.
Shit. Yeah, right? Heyo. Wow. Just chill.
You've watched
right?
YouTube videos longer than that, people.
It's available on the Criterion channel. I don't see it available for rental anywhere. So go and subscribe to the Criterion channel. I'm sure they have monthly plans. They have yearly plans. We're big fans. If you're a cinephile, you really should have
a Criterion channel. Look.
In your home, truly.
If you're the right type of person, you've already canceled your Disney Plus account. Yes. Take those funds and pop for a Criterion. It is so much more bang for your buck.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much on there. It's absolutely kind of insane. I mean, like, you think of, okay, well, sure, Agnes Varda movies and, like, Pather Panchali. Almost every, like, Godzilla movie is on there. You know what I mean? Like, every Zatoichi movie is on there. Like, every Lone Wolf and Cub movie. Like, there's so much on
there. The 70s thriller collection they got right now is, like, Chinatown, Night Moves, Sorcerer. I mean, anything Pakula is on there. So just go get it.
Remember, we get no money from this. We actually give money to Criterion Channel.
Yeah.
So we are boosters. We are net promoters for sure. Our net promoter score off the fucking charts. But yes, Vagabond. Come back in 2 weeks. We'll read Vagabond. Agnes Varda directed. Sandron Benir stars. Criterion Channel streams. We talk. You listen. Everybody wins.
And I know we're trying to steer this bus home, but Dan.
Yo.
Etsy wishes are having a moment right now.
Etsy wishes? What are that?
Etsy witches.
Etsy witches?
Yeah, so people are, there's witches on Etsy. You can ask to grant you curses. And people are doing it for, like, the baseball playoffs.
Oh, great.
And I'm saying we enlist one to give us our next random numbers. I don't know how they would do it, but just, like, maybe we'll table this discussion. We'll talk a little, but Etsy witches. I think they would get us a really good one.
I'm sure they would. There's nothing but really good ones, I think, as we found.
Oh, we see, there's the flaw in my
really bad ones. There's not too many really bad ones.
There's the flaw in my plan.
And tallying them up, I had a whole spreadsheet here. I don't have it with me. I don't have it up right now. But of how many movies have we, of all the films we reviewed, how many have we said are sound versus slight? Which one of us? Was it both of us?
Yeah.
There's only like two where it was both of us, two or three or something like that. And even then, it's not like, wow, we hated this movie, you know, like fucking the next 365 days. Like,
this was
hard to watch, but it was more like, this just isn't one of the, you know, 300 greatest movies of all time kind of thing. So, anyway.
All right. Until next episode, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com, find support the show in the menu, or look for the donate button. For Canada Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes, saying skibbity boppity bop, save us a seat in the bibbity boppity bop back row, pop pop, skidoopa da ba. Yeah.
Wow, bitch.
Right, you didn't see that coming.